Star Trek and Star Wars fans might not like the discussion this hour because our guest believes that we might be alone in the universe without all those other exotic civilizations, maybe even without bacteria and mosses and lower forms of life. Because life is tough, maybe too tough for other planets to foster. Before you think, now, come on, somewhere there must be life besides Earth, hear our guest out. His book is Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. David Waltham is a geophysicist and astrobiologist working in the Department of Earth Sciences at Royal Holloway College, the University of London. He takes special note of his work on the evolution of the Earth-Moon system over the last 4.5 billion years, and he's our guest on The Exchange. David Waltham, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
It's not every day we talk to an astrobiologist. What does that term even mean?
Oh, it's people who are interested in the possibility of life on other planets. So there's lots of different things we can do. I mean, some of us are looking into how you would try and detect it if it is there. Others are interested in, you know, what kinds of biochemistry might happen on other planets. So it's a very wide subject, but anything to do with the possibility of life elsewhere.
Can we assume then that you would like to believe that there is life in other places?
I would love to believe it. In a sense, I'm disappointed by my own discoveries. I would be absolutely delighted to be proved wrong in many ways.
And there's a great quote early in the book where you say, there are many ways of getting a world wrong, but few ways of getting it right.
Yes, that's essentially where I'm starting from. The thing we've discovered as we've looked at more and more planets is the incredible variety of them. And there's just so many different ways to make a planet. And as far as we know so far, there's only one way which will give you a very rich biosphere like the one we've got on Earth.
So a very narrow range of circumstances then need to coalesce.
That is the argument, that lots of things have to go right. And if lots of things have to go right, even if, you know, the chances of each one is reasonably good, let's say 1 in 10, but if you've got 20 such things that need to go right at a 1 in 10 chance, then you quickly get to the point where there's no other good examples in the entire visible universe.
Now, a lot has changed over the course of our lifetimes. I mean, I remember talking to the librarian in elementary school about other solar systems, and she said, are there other solar systems? I said, well, you know, I was thinking about Krypton and all that sort of thing. But
yeah.
The fact is, we have learned a whole lot about exoplanets just in the last few decades, haven't we?
That's right. I mean, we didn't know of any until the mid-90s. And since then, especially thanks to the Kepler mission from NASA, we now know of literally thousands. So one thing that has, as it were, got better for the prospects of life is that we do at least now know that planets are common. You know, stars are probably more likely to have planets than not have planets.
That is that's the balance then? I mean, generally more likely to have planets than not?
Yes, I think that's the view that's coming out from Kepler is that the majority, perhaps not a large majority, but certainly a majority of stars probably have planets.
There's an analogy you draw in the book, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, though, about the ways in which we detect exoplanets. And you draw it to something more earthbound, and I can't remember what that is. But, I mean, is it a reliable system? Are we reasonably certain there are that many exoplanets out there?
Yes. I mean, it's a classic piece of science, really. And the first discoveries were very debatable, and people didn't quite believe it. But then others just went out and made the same measurements. And yeah, so many of these measurements have now been repeated, and particularly with the spaceborne searches, where by getting above the atmosphere, you can make much, much more accurate measurements. I don't think there's any real doubt that those planets are there. There's no controversy over that, as far as I'm aware.
Just given the general realm, then, I mean, the size of the universe, the number of stars, the potential number of exoplanets out there, I mean, wouldn't the odds be somewhat good that some other place could support life?
My view is actually perhaps slightly more of a nuance than you've suggested. I don't think we're alone. I think we're effectively alone. Now, what that means is that the nearest planet to us which might have contactable life on it is probably so far away that they'll be literally beyond the edge of the observable universe, and therefore there's no possibility of contacting them. But actually, I do think there are so many planets in the universe that there are almost certainly other planets with life out there and other planets with advanced civilizations. But yeah, effectively we're alone because we're never actually going to make contact with them.
Hmm. Okay. So the basis based on technology and distance, then unlikely to make that kind of contact.
Yeah.
The planet Nemesis, early, are you setting up something of a straw planet early in the book?
That's right, yes. Yeah, the idea was a twin to the Earth, where there was only one small difference. And so I just told the story of this planet, which effectively is the story of Earth and how life evolved and became gradually more complex. But then on Nemesis, I tell the story of a disaster, a climatic disaster, where things just stop going right and start going wrong. And really the view that's in the book is that that's what's going to happen to most planets, that it takes a lot of luck to, as it were, stay on the straight and narrow, keep a planet habitable for billions of years is what's difficult. And so most planets where life even starts, it will get wiped out by some kind of climate disaster before it gets to the point where there's intelligent life on it.
We are talking to David Waltham, the British geophysicist and astrobiologist working in the Department of Earth Sciences at Royal Holloway College. His book is Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. And as you've heard him say, there's a chance there could be life out there, but probably very far away from us. We'll talk more about the general argument about life on other planets and our chances of making contact with them at some point and what the conditions are that create life in a place like Earth. The so-called lucky planet. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return from this break. Back on the Exchange with David Waltham and your phone calls and emails in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is David Waltham, British geophysicist and astrobiologist. He is the author of the book Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. It might not be a Goldilocks story so much as an even rarer sort of case than that, where it really takes a lot of conditions going right to produce life on a planet. We'll talk more about this as we go through the program. You can join us at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you write early in the book that worlds like ours are extraordinarily rare, but there are vast numbers of them, which seems like a contradiction in terms, but how does that work?
Well, that really comes back to what I was saying earlier about the fact I think we're effectively alone. What I'm really saying is that there are so many planets in the universe, and the numbers are enormous. The number in the visible universe is probably about the same as the number of grains in a cubic mile of sand. It's a fantastically large number. Given that large number, life doesn't have to be very common. It can be extraordinarily rare, and it's still going to happen lots of times. So that's where that contradiction comes in. I'm essentially saying it's probably extraordinarily rare. Maybe we'll get a planet like ours, you know, once in a galaxy or once in 1,000 galaxies or once in 1,000,000 galaxies. But even then, there will be lots of them just because the universe is so large. But in that extreme case, as I said before, they'd be so far away that we're not going to make contact with them. So we are effectively alone.
You talk about the principle of mediocrity. What does that mean? Is it we see the Earth as mediocre, like we expect things to happen like they do on the Earth?
Yeah, it's a revolution in science that happened 500 years ago, that we started to realize that the Earth and the heavens were made of the same stuff, and that the stars and the planets and the moons and so on weren't vastly different in physical and chemical sense. So that began with Copernicus telling us that the Earth wasn't at the center of the solar system, but actually went round the Sun. And then we slowly came to realize that the Sun was just one star amongst many. And then more recently, we've discovered that even our galaxy of a few hundred billion stars is not unique, and there are billions of those. So the historical trend has been to demote the significance of the planet through time. We've become a small lump of rock going around a typical star in a very normal galaxy. And this is what's called the principle of mediocrity. Now, essentially, I'm assuming we've perhaps taken that too far, and that in some ways the Earth might be unusual. There's no particular reason to think that this principle of mediocrity is necessarily always right. It may actually break down when we start to look at things like the Earth's capacity to support life.
There's a name you introduce us to in this section of the book, too, Giordano Bruno. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he was the one of the first to actually take Copernicus's suggestion that the planets went round the sun to its fairly logical conclusion. He was one of quite a few people who said this, that if that's the case, then maybe the stars are just other suns, and maybe they've got planets too. And that's where the search for planets around other stars came from. Unfortunately, he got into a lot of trouble with the church at the time because they didn't like what he was saying. They actually didn't like lots of things about him. It wasn't just that he thought that the stars were just suns with planets too. There were lots of other things about his politics, and he got involved in spying and all sorts of things he shouldn't have got mixed up in. And eventually he was burnt at the stake. Now, the excuse that was made for burning him was that he was a heretic, that he was proposing this idea that the Earth was, you know, just one planet amongst many, and that there are lots of other suns and planets around. But in reality, it was probably more of a political thing. He was in deep trouble, particularly with the Spanish. And as a consequence of that, he was caught and eventually put to death. But he's become something of a scientific hero because of this. But the story is, as always, much more interesting than just the he was proposing science be the way we move forward, and that was opposed by religion. It really wasn't that simple.
And there are some interesting details we didn't get to there either, but you have to read the book for those. Let's invite some listeners in to join us. Here's Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Waltham, the author of Lucky Planet.
Thank you very much. As Mr. Waltham knows, the vast, incomprehensible size of the universe is sort of a small part of the problem. The real problem is temporal. If you were watching the Earth, the time it took to form, the time it was just hanging out, and then finally developing life, is a gnat's blink in the universe. The chances of simultaneous civilization, simultaneous sentient life arising, is less governed by the size of the universe than by the size of time. For them to overlap is astoundingly, incalculably small. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call, Grumpy John. Appreciate that. And David, you do address that in the book. I mean, the fact is we're not just talking about things that can happen in space, but time windows as well.
Yes, I'm not sure I completely agree with what we just heard. I mean, there's been life on Earth for something like 4 billion years, and the universe is only 14 billion years old. So in terms of just finding life elsewhere, the windows are really quite large. I think your listener's quite right to say that perhaps civilizations don't last very long, and therefore that's another possible explanation why they're not very obvious in the sky. We're not seeing them. It's because they don't last long. And many people have suggested that possibility. My view is that they very rarely arise in the first place. There may be an additional problem in that they don't last long either.
Let us take another call. Here's Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Waltham, the author of Lucky Planet.
Hey, back in the 70s, I recall hearing some theories that it was possible to have a silicone-based life form as opposed to a carbon-based life form, a life form like we have on Earth. And I wonder if you're limiting your theorization to just what's happening on the carbon-based model if you're not covering all your bases.
Well, let's find out. Thank you for that, Steve.
Yeah. No, that is a very good question indeed, and it's a difficult one to answer. The reality is that we have to start from what we know, and so the argument is based around what we know about Earth life, so it is carbon-based and assumes liquid water is very important and those kinds of things. But having said that, my view is that it's almost back to that principle of mediocrity, that even if intelligent life is very rare, we're more likely to be a typical type of intelligent life than a non-typical type of intelligent life. So I don't think it's a bad place to start. We should start with our kind of life. But as much as anything, that's because, well, what else can you do? You've got to start somewhere. But, I mean, absolutely right. If there are other types of life around, then that massively complicates the problem.
David, what is the anthropic selection effect?
Well, that's the fact that we're sitting here, we're having this phone conversation, really. And that really constrains the kind of history that we kind of had, in that the way it's been put is that the history of the universe and the history of the Earth and so on must be compatible with the fact that we exist. Now, that means that we can't live on a planet that's too small to have an atmosphere. We can't live on a planet that's too close to its sun. Yeah, we must live on a planet that's just right for life, by definition. Now, if places that are suitable for life are very rare, what that means is that the conditions on the Earth could actually be very, very unusual, could be very rare. That's the anthropic selection effect.
We're talking to David Waltham, a British geophysicist and astrobiologist, and the author of the book Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Waltham.
Gentlemen, I'm still trying to figure out what went wrong here.
How so?
Well, where's the intelligent life?
Well, you give us a little credit here, don't you?
Well, some, but not much. Seriously, on a serious note, based on what you're saying, I completely agree with you in terms of what we know about Einsteinian physics, string theory, Newtonian physics, all of that. What if the theories regarding the multiverse are more correct, or if the concepts of plasma physics and the holographic universe, as championed by Dr. Miller and some of these other people, are correct? Does that change the probability of contact with others?
It does in a very subtle way. I actually do have a couple of chapters in my book on multiverses and so on, because this whole idea of anthropic selection was originally devised to try and work out why the universe seems to be life-friendly rather than why planets are life-friendly. But the same kind of idea applies to planets. Now, I actually do think there's a lot of credibility to these multiverse theories, and what they do, the effect they have is that they allow you to explain why our universe might be much more life-friendly than you might otherwise expect. So the way I put it in the book is that we need to decide between whether we live on a lucky planet or in a lucky universe. Now, my actual view is that it's a bit of both. We live in a reasonably good universe on a reasonably good planet, and the chances of that happening are actually very small. Does that answer your question?
Thanks for that. Let me see if Paul's back on. Paul, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you for calling. Let's take another call. Let's go to Don in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Waltham, the author of Lucky Planet.
Hi, David. I was just thinking, as I watched my little tomato plants grow, those are from seeds that I saved from last year. And have you ever thought about the reverse engineered universe where, you know, we realize that maybe this Earth isn't going to last forever, and so we take some examples of the genes from the archaea, you know, the things that eat rocks and don't need oxygen, that preceded us in the procession of life. And, you know, have you ever thought about, just as a thought experiment, you know, if you wanted to propagate life, like I seem to have propagated these tomatoes, if you wanted to do that, and, I mean, I don't mean like kryptonite or some ad, but, you know, throwing these things out somewhere, if that gave you an idea of what to look for that might be floating around out there that was purposefully sent.
All right.
Yeah, this whole idea is, it goes by the name of panspermia. It's the idea that life gets distributed through space. Now, there are several different types of panspermia. One type is just that nearby planets can exchange microbes because of meteorites hitting them and literally knocking chunks off. And if those chunks then fly out into space and then meet another planet, that can transfer microbes between those worlds. And it's quite possible that that's happened between Earth and Mars. And my view is that we're probably going to find life on Mars for that reason. But it's probably just Earth life that's been transported there. So that's one kind of panspermia. Another kind is to suggest that it might be possible to move bacteria and viruses and so on actually between stellar systems. Now, that's much, much more controversial. The figures don't seem to add up. Those organisms just won't survive long enough in space to get to where they need to. But there's a third kind, and I think that's what you're getting at, which is called directed panspermia. And this is the idea that there are intelligent organisms elsewhere in the universe who've deliberately seeded space in that way. Now, it's a fascinating idea. I do love it, and I'd love to sit around and talk to you about it over a few beers at some time, perhaps. But I'd have to say at the moment there's no evidence for it, and that's really all I could say. It's not to say it's wrong, but where's the evidence?
It's a popular concept in science fiction, I know. You know, oh, that's why there's so many humanoids throughout the galaxy, because somebody seeded them there, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You just mentioned the idea, though, of chunks getting thrown off. The idea of planets sharing rocks is still a difficult one, certainly for me to grasp. So basically, things collided with such force that chunks of the planet were actually thrown off into space?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like the asteroid that might have wiped out the dinosaurs. You know, when that hit Mexico 65 million years ago, that was a large enough piece of rock and it hit the Earth hard enough that some of those chunks of Earth would have literally been thrown into space. Now, if those chunks had organisms on them, believe it or not, they could actually survive that. It's quite surprising, but microbes are tough little things, and if they're inside a big enough chunk of rock, they'll actually survive and get thrown into space. Now, if that chunk of rock then later on collides with Mars, there you are. You've managed to move a bug from Mexico to Mars, and maybe it would find suitable conditions when it got there to survive. So it's certainly a plausible idea, but there's, as I just said about the directed panspermia, at the moment we've got no evidence for it, but it certainly is a plausible suggestion.
Well, back to the basic idea here, though, which is that the Earth is a lucky planet because the conditions to create life here are unique, certainly unique in our portion of the universe that we know of. And then you have a comparison section of the book about planets and moons and the things that are peculiar to each, and you point out that Earth has continents that move, and that phrase alone made me stop and think, oh, I guess we just assume that happens. It doesn't necessarily happen on other bodies in the sky.
No, it doesn't even happen on Venus. Now, Venus is the nearest, sometimes it's called our evil twin sister. It's the nearest planet to Earth in terms of size and makeup, but it's a completely different world. And it doesn't have continents that move. The plate tectonics, the way that the oceans gradually widen through time and push the continents around, that whole process just doesn't happen on Venus at all. It looks like as if it may have happened very early on Mars, when Mars was very young. There may have been something similar there, but it stopped very quickly. But the problem with Mars is it's too small. It got cold very quickly, so it no longer had that heat engine inside it. And the trouble with Venus is probably a lack of water, in that water, believe it or not, actually lubricates the plates in a sense. Helps plate tectonics to happen.
Do we make the assumption that water is absolutely necessary for life? Is it?
I think it's a very good assumption, but it is an assumption. We've only got one example of life, and that's Earth, and so until we find another, we have to make these guesses. But it certainly would seem that life requires some kind of medium for transporting nutrients and for dissolving things in that kind of activity. And it's very hard to think of another liquid that would do the job as well. There are many properties of water that are really quite unique. And the other point about it is that water is by far the most common liquid in the universe. Hydrogen and oxygen, from which it's made, are very common elements. Hydrogen is the most common element in the universe. Oxygen is one of the most common. So lots of places have water, and it's very good at helping life. We know that because that's what happens on Earth. So I don't think we really need to appeal to exotic biochemistries that use other liquids. I think the life that is out there in the universe is almost certainly going to be based on water too. But as I said at the beginning, it's an assumption. We don't really know.
All right, we're still making a lot of assumptions, and we'll discuss more of what David Waltham is about in his book, Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional, and what that means for life in the universe. We'll come back and talk more with David and take your phone calls and emails as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British geophysicist and astrobiologist David Waltham. He is the author of the book Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What This Means for Life in the Universe. Not that we are necessarily alone, but effectively alone, because if life exists elsewhere in the universe, it's probably very far away. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call from Julie in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Waltham.
Hi there. Hi. Thank you. I have often had this theory in my mind, and I'm kind of wondering if anyone has ever put this forth before to your knowledge. You know the concept of rotating crops, where you leave a piece of land unused for a while so it can regain its nutrient base.
So something lays fallow, right. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking, why not rotate planets? And maybe we have been doing this. If life is so rare and it's so hard to find a planet that would sustain our kind of life, why not rotate between Mars and Earth? And all we have to do is learn the science of jump-starting water and the kind of life we need on Mars. And, you know, knowing that our nature is to just totally use up a planet, it seems we can't stop ourselves. So if we rotated, it would be kind of smart. And there was one more thing. Oh, this is just a fun little comment. I think I would enjoy living on Mars because I'd have a longer year and maybe I could get more done.
All right. Thanks for that, Julie. Appreciate the thoughts. Well, this is some easier said than done thinking here in some cases, right?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thought. I mean, there is almost certainly the need for us eventually to move away from the Earth because the sun is gradually getting warmer, and within about a billion years or so, it will be too hot for life to remain on Earth. So we may have to move to Mars at that point, but that's a long, long way off, and there are many other ways we can ruin things before we get that far. As for making planets more habitable for us, I mean, there is a technique called terraforming that people have speculated about how to go to places like Mars and so on, and to produce a thicker atmosphere and make them warmer so they've got water and so on. And these are quite credible suggestions for how it might be done. I'm actually concerned about the morality of it, to be honest. I think, particularly if I'm right and there really is some primitive life on Mars, for us to go there and just sort of take it over, I think it's something we really need to sit and think about before we do it.
We remake it instead of taking it as we find it.
Yeah, yeah.
You say we should not be looking so much outward for discussions of life, but inward to our own rocks. Why?
What I'm getting at there is that the history of life is written in the rocks. We can say much, much more about how life evolved and appeared and how it develops by looking at fossils than we at the moment can tell by looking up at the stars. So at the moment, I think it's still true to say that if you want to think about life on other planets, you're better off looking down rather than looking up. That situation is gradually changing. We are, finding out more about exoplanets and so on. So there is at least some information that we can now glean by looking upwards. But it's still the case that the best information about how life can evolve is from geology, not from astronomy.
And you point out the age of the Earth and some analogies for looking at this, but the sum total of that section is that it's we have to grasp that there have been many changes already over the life of the planet. And one of the major things you bring up is the greenhouse effect, which, of course, we fear to some extent now. But the fact is it really does make life possible, doesn't it?
Yes, without the greenhouse effect, the planet would be completely frozen. We'd be about 30 degrees Celsius cooler. What's that, 60 Fahrenheit cooler? It'd be an awful lot colder, and life probably wouldn't be possible. But the key is to have the right amount of greenhouse effect. You don't want too much, and you don't want too little. And the core of the book really is about the fact that the Earth has always got that right throughout its history. When the Earth was young, the sun was a lot fainter, and we had a stronger greenhouse effect. And as the sun has gradually got brighter through time, the Earth's greenhouse effect has slowly reduced. And really the core of the book is that I don't think that's a control mechanism. I think that was just plain good luck.
Good luck. And you know, just, again, that something that just happened to happen that gave us the benefit of being able to exist.
Yeah. On our planet, things just happened at the right rate for the evolution of organisms on the planet in particular to change the environment at just the right speed to counteract that warming of the sun. And my view is that that's unlikely to happen on most other planets. Most planets will either evolve too quickly and they'll lose their greenhouse effect too fast and get cold, or they won't evolve quickly enough and therefore the greenhouse effect won't fall off quickly enough. And at that point, the warming of their sun will again make the planet uninhabitable. So, as I say, that is the core idea in the book.
And obviously there's a natural progression into discussion of climate change and greenhouse gases on Earth now. And you point out that much of your research funding comes from the oil industry?
That's right, yes. Astrobiology is a relatively new area for me. I've been working on it for about 10 years now, so quite a long time. But before that, you know, as a geophysicist, my main research has been involved with developing computer models for oil companies, in particular how sedimentary rocks form and how they change through time and how that helps you to find oil.
And as you point out, though, that you've been looking for ways to refute the climate scientists and haven't found one.
Yeah, the more I look at it, the more I think they're right. There you go.
You said you'd be happy to collect your Nobel Prize if you could find the flaw, but you can't find a flaw.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, that's, for me, the most convincing reason why I believe the climate scientists, because the way science works is that you can become extremely well-known and famous and successful in science by proving everyone else wrong. So there have been lots of people out there trying to prove the climate scientists wrong, and so far they really haven't succeeded.
Let us take another call. We have Mark in Redding, California on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Waltham, the author of Lucky Planet.
Good morning. I have the opposite hypothesis of the previous caller. My hypothesis is that we were on Mars, we made a mess of it, we came here, and now we're not terraforming this planet, we're Marsifying it.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, at the moment we seem to be doing the opposite, and the trouble with Mars, from a life point of view, is it's got too cold, and it's most of its water is now locked up beneath the surface, frozen into the crust, and there's quite a lot in the poles as well. So Mars has really got too cold for life, or at least for a complex biosphere. So at the moment we're not Marsifying, we're actually Venusifying it, but we've got a long way to go, thank goodness.
All right, long way before it gets as hot as it does on Venus.
Yeah.
One of the keys to the book would appear to be the keys to your overall set of theories is that it's not just that planets go through changes, but life is able to adapt. Evolution keeps up with the changes, drastic though they may be. And the fact is that it wouldn't have taken much, it would appear, over time through the Earth's history for life to disappear completely.
Yeah, we've been, as I say, lucky. It got close at one time. There's a particular period in history, about 600 million years ago, when we didn't quite get it right. The planet didn't quite get it right. The greenhouse effect dropped too quickly, and the Earth went into what's been called a snowball state. That it was probably, it could easily have been 50 degrees or more cooler, 50 degrees centigrade cooler than today. And the ice caps extended all the way to the equator from the poles. but it didn't quite wipe life out. There must have been some oases, some pools of liquid water remaining, you know, perhaps in the deep ocean or somewhere like that, that allowed life to just cling on by its fingernails, as it were. And then when that ice all melted, it bounced back very vigorously. And there's a lot of evidence that immediately after that is when animals first appeared. So it was close, but we were lucky.
So the Earth has actually had a restart a couple of times, it sounds like.
Yes, yeah, and that's part of the argument, really, is that those sorts of things, you'd expect these things to happen on a planet, especially a wet one. I mean, the trouble really is that, it's coming back to water again, if you need water for life, then life is always going to be on planets that have water on them. And wet planets inherently have unstable climates. Water, when it evaporates, is a greenhouse gas. So if you evaporate water, the planet gets hotter and hotter and hotter. If you freeze water, it turns into ice, which reflects heat into space. So if a planet gets colder and makes more and more ice, it will reflect more heat and get even colder. So water just inherently makes climates unstable. But you've got to have it for life. So that's really the central thesis, that planets with life are also planets that have unstable climates.
The cycle you just referred to, the feedback loops, that's actually a major discussion point right now with the discussion of climate change.
Yes. The issue really is it does boil down to the strength of the feedbacks. There are feedbacks that have the opposite effect, that reduce warming if it gets hot and warm things back up again if it starts to get cold. And there certainly are those types of negative feedback in the Earth's climate system. But all the evidence we have suggests that the positive feedbacks outweigh the negative feedbacks. So overall, the Earth's climate is inherently a little bit unstable.
And the ice ages generally, I mean, how regular are these periods through the planet's history that we are able to tell?
They seem to be driven by fluctuations in the Earth's orbit and in the tilt of the Earth's axis. And those are very regular because those are driven by astronomical processes. So we can put really quite precise numbers on their periods. But the trouble is there's quite a lot of them. There are cycles that vary the Earth's shape of the Earth's orbit and the tilt of the Earth's orbit, and then others that vary the tilt of the Earth's axis and so on. And these are all interacting with each other. So the overall picture is quite a complex one. But fundamentally, it is being driven by very regular cycles.
We should point out that the book was obviously written before the World Cup started, but there's an interesting analogy to intelligent life and football games here.
Yes, that was about an observation that was made quite a few decades ago, that there's a strange coincidence that the length of time for which our planet is habitable is probably about 5 billion years. Much more than that, the sun gets too hot. And it's taken 4 billion years for intelligent life to emerge. So the argument is that we don't expect those things, that coincidence. Evolution of intelligence is a very different thing to the nuclear physics in stars. So the fact that there's that coincidence needs an explanation. And the standard explanation is that intelligence is actually a very hard thing to get and hardly ever happens. And therefore, when it does happen, it nearly always happens at the end, at the end of the habitable period. Now, the football analogy comes because the argument really boils down to that there's lots of steps to get to intelligence. So the analogy I've drawn is imagine a football game where you need to score 10 goals. Most games it won't happen, so most planets won't have intelligent life. But in the games where you do get 10 goals, that 10th goal is nearly always going to be near the end of the game. It's very unlikely that you're going to get 10 goals in the first 5 minutes and then nothing for the rest of the game. So from that analogy, we'd expect those few planets that do, as it were, score all the goals and get intelligence. Intelligence is going to evolve right at the end of their habitable period.
But that works on the assumption that that the intelligence is not great enough to be able to control physical forces, and but that perhaps extend the life of the planet?
Well, that's an interesting point. Of course, all of this is about what happened up until now. I mean, the book is really about us. It's not about aliens. It's about humans and about Earth, and we've got to where we are, and it's up to us what we do next. So, I think the fact we have emerged completely changes the game. We're now in a new game.
David, have you had any discussions with other scientists about the theories that you put out in Lucky Planet and their responses to it, their reactions?
Yeah, the book is actually based on half a dozen papers that I've published on the subject over the last 10 years. So I've certainly had a lot of debates with people. I don't always go down well with other astrobiologists because, as you pointed out at the beginning, I'm basically saying there isn't any. Or at least it's very rare, and obviously that some may feel that that's undermining their interest in their science. But generally, I get a good hearing.
So, what's the sum total that people should take away from what you said in Lucky Planet? I mean, should they feel rejoiced that hey, you know, we're unique, we made it, you know, and very few other civilizations have, or should people feel lonely?
Well, certainly the message I take from it is that we're very lucky to exist at all, and. Yeah, for me, this just emphasizes how fantastic it is to be alive. That's the message I would take.
The book is called Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. It is the product of the British geophysicist and astrobiologist David Waltham, who's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. David, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure. That'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page as well, with the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow, Tuesday, on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about cameras for traffic light changes coming into play in Medford now. We'll talk about the high bacteria levels and not good bacteria in creeks in Jackson County. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk about opera, the most exotic entertainment. That's all tomorrow, Tuesday, on the Jefferson Exchange. The Jefferson Exchange producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.